Blog Talk Radio.
Blah, 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 Here. I'm having a wrestling match. I'm losing to a very fat kitten. And I'll tell you, it's some kind of fun this week, huh? It seems like, well, might as well get the elephant out in the open. It looks like Yuri House TV is temporarily kaputsky. But we're taking measures to find a replacement, a suitable venue to continue and maintain some high-quality entertainment with horror hosts, monster movies, and science fiction. All that fun stuff. But we got a fine topic today, I think, to discuss. Reference books. Horror and science fiction reference books. Or as we used to call them, coffee table books. You know, those large-sized books, usually hardback, but some softbound. As a monster kid growing up in the 70s, I was very fond of the advertisements for all this cool stuff, and amongst them were these wonderful books that I've picked up over the years. I'd like to share some of those today, a little bit about them, and maybe entice you to go out to Amazon or somewhere and try to find a copy or two if you like it yourself. Who knows? But there's some there's some really good stuff, and you know, it was always exciting reading the old monster mags and reading the ads, looking at the giant-sized Frankenstein and all the other cool ads. But I was drawn to the books. I was a very avid reader. I wish I had time to read as I used to, but I currently do not. although, if I don't find a venue quick, I might be reading a lot and rereading some of these fine classics I'd like to share with you today. If you'd like to join in the conversation, call in, please, at 646-378-0264 and dial or punch those keys very carefully. I don't want them lawsuits or anything like that. I couldn't tell you for the life of me what order I picked these books up, other than I can recall the very first one, which is not the first one I want to discuss. The first book I want to discuss is probably the most elementary. It's a great book to give a preteen who's interested in science fiction and monsters and mythology or comic books even. And I'm talking about a book called Monsters Who's Who. And it looks like it was copyrighted in 1974. I don't see a particular author credited here. But it's from A to Z, all the blood-curdling horrors you love to fear. And I think it's written very, very well. It's very, very basic. It's by Crescent Books, a division of Crown Publishers at the time. And basically, alphabetically, they lay out as many monsters and even creatures of Greek mythology are listed in here. And it's very educational. I think a great primer, if you will, for a young horror and sci-fi enthusiast who has an appreciation for the older stuff, too. There's everything you could possibly imagine in here, including some dinosaurs. Blue Men of the Minch? I have no idea what that is. Let me read this to you. The strait between the Outer Hebrides and the western coast of Scotland is the home of the Blue Men of the Minch. As this strait is called, they're a form of evil mermen. Oh, okay, colored blue all over, hence the name, I would imagine. They are always restless and on the lookout for mischief, and thus are believed to cause storms. Sometimes they actually attack ships passing through the Minch and try to wreck them. They can be argued with, however. I don't know about the wisdom of that. And it is believed that the captain of a ship can always out-talk them. He can do this more easily if he can speak to them in rhyme, for this confuses the blue men. Oh, great. I'll remember when I'm traveling through there to take Dr. Seuss. When they are asleep, it is said the weather is sure to be fine and the sea is calm. All right, yeah, that's a little something. If I knew it before, I had forgotten. But there's tons and tons of entries in this book, and I highly recommend it. It was one, at the time I got it, I was a little disappointed because I was already in my late teens, I would say, when I picked that up. And, you know, I was like, oh, I'm kind of beyond this. But then as I picked it up over the years, there was more and more interesting things and even some things I didn't know, just like now. Do you have any favorite books like that? You know, stuff that you've picked up over the years, whether you ordered it through a magazine, whether you picked it up at a trade show or an old bookstore. There's just so many of these. And I enjoy every one of them. They talk about pretty much my favorite things in life, which
monster, sex, and rock and roll.
That's right. And the very first the very first book I picked up, this was again through the mail, it was very exciting to wait for it. It's A Pictorial History of Horror Movies by Dennis Gifford. And it has a great cover. It almost looks like a Basil Gogos drawing on it. Maybe it is. Artwork on both the front and the back with, you know, a montage of all the classic monster movies. And they discuss kind of the history. You know, and there's it being a pictorial, that's great too. There's some great stills in here that you don't ordinarily see on the internet or anywhere. But there's great stills. There's pictures of posters and lobby cards that they had back in the day. Some good behind the scenes shots. Some brief descriptions on how they did the effects. And it's well written, and I think you guys would like it. Check this out. Again, it's called A Pictorial History of Monster Movies by Dennis Gifford. I put photos of some of these books. If you're watching your screen, if you're logged in on the radio, you can see some of the photos flying by of some of these great books. And this Dennis Gifford one was one of my, again, one of my favorite books that I own. I've had this since the mid-70s. There's just tons and tons of photos you don't see everywhere. Dennis Gifford, I guess, used to draw comics for kids. How about that? Another book I got early that I just had to get my greasy mitts on, being a fan of special effects and how they were done, I had to get The Making of King Kong by Orville Goldner and George E. Turner. And what a fantastic book this is. Now, this one I have in paperback version. But again, a big, large coffee table-sized book. And it gets into everything about the making of the movie, starting with a little brief history of Willis O'Brien. And also Kurt Schodizak, who... Ernest Schodizak, who produced the movie. It gets into how the story was created. There's some wonderful photos in this one as well. It shows some of the armatures of Willis O'Brien's early works, including something called The Missing Link from 1916, when he was experimenting in silent films with his animation and model making. I found some interesting stuff, as well as the visual effects and stop-motion animation. I was kind of amazed at some of the other things that the crew came up with for the film, including recording, doing interesting things with sound recordings for your monster roars and the gorilla grunting. For example, one of the dinosaurs, they played a lion's roar backwards at half speed, roughly half speed. And They were just neat things that, you know, sparked my imagination when I was fooling around with movies as a kid, things you could do and sound effects you could create on your own. With the technology they have on the internet, you can go crazy with this stuff. There's sound programs you can do all kinds of crazy stuff with. But this book is just an absolute font of information if you're interested in the special effects of the day. You have to keep in mind the movie came out in 1933, and some of these techniques came from just after the turn of the century. So it's a good read and a book I highly recommend. I guess I wouldn't have bought them if I didn't highly recommend them. But The Making of King Kong, I find that fascinating. Going to take a brief break, and we will be right back.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Time. I hope you guys all had a great Thanksgiving. I have much to be thankful for, but one of those things is not Eerie TV. Yeah, I'm grateful for having done what I've done with it so far, but not real grateful about what happened there. I don't know. Books, we're talking about books. There's so many good ones out there. I was fortunate enough to find employment early in life, and I always had money as a youth to buy cool things. And another one of my favorite purchases is a book called Monsters by Vincent Price and V.B. Price. Obviously a child of his, but this is a nice book, too. It gets into the psychological part, I think, of monsters, from primordial creatures, as he starts out in chapter one, to how the images on film or in mythology or urban legends, the things that that we've called monsters, including real live living things like certain insects and animals that are quite dangerous that can be considered monsters, vampire bats and pythons and tarantulas, all kinds of fun stuff. Talks about some of the lore, such as the Loch Ness Monster, and just, again, it's a very cerebral approach to how we look at monsters and how they affect our psyche and what makes them scary to us, and maybe how some of these myths and legends from days gone by, how they started, and some of the visual adaptations of things that ancient artists and woodcutters have created that have invaded our dreams and sparked our imaginations for some of the fine movies that we like. But Vincent Price, the guy did everything. He was a cook. He was obviously an actor. A bit of a comic. He sang a bit. And a writer, too. Monsters by Vincent Price and V.B. Price. Another fine, fine book. Here's one I'd like to take a look with and share with a little bit about with you. And it's a monster. This one I bought actually in a bookstore. it would probably cost a fortune in postage because it's a heavy book. somebody breaks here into Erie House or Dale K's Spook Show section of it, they're looking for trouble. If I hit them with this book, I'm putting them out because this thing should be registered as a weapon. And it's the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction Movies by Phil Hardy. Now, I tried to find some more information about this particular book online, and I cannot find one with this particular cover. It's a hardbound book with a green binder and a green cover, and then the jacket, which is in really nice shape because it's not one I've overread, is predominantly green. Now, I have seen online other versions of it, and the artwork on the cover of the book suggests that it is a subsequent edition because this one ends its chronology. I'll get into the chronology a little later, but it ends at 1985, which is about when I should have picked up this book. So I was already in my mid-late 20s. The other versions show movies that precede this history, such as Mars Attacks and some other neat things. So obviously the book's been expanded on maybe over the years. I can't tell you for certain. But what I do love about this, it really is written in encyclopedia format. But what I really like about it is the preface and the early period in 1895 to 1919 in the silent era. So many films by George Méliès. It's incredible. In fact, the vast majority of early science fiction and horror stories from the late 1800s and the early 1900s are foreign. And they're not. And in that period, many of them are not long. They're a minute and 2 minute long versions. A Trip to the Moon, the version that we all are familiar with, the original version, is not. It predates it. There's a version here they list from 1898, and the version that we're most used to seeing in today's culture was released in 1903, which is also listed in this book. So apparently Méliès made it a second time. And redid it. It's neat because they show the exact year when it came out, the running time, some credits, and it's a very complete history of science fiction movies. Now, there's a lot of crossover. They consider Frankenstein, which is listed in this book, as science fiction, which is a fair assessment. I mean, it medicine is a form of science, and you know, in a science fiction-y kind of way, they created the monster. So, yeah, I'm buying into that. They list everything. I love the section on the 1950s when a good deal of science fiction was a little corny. But there's great stuff in here, too, like the Thing from Another World. There's so much to learn in here about very, very obscure films. And films I had never heard of when I bought the book, so it was you need to use it kind of like an encyclopedia because to read it from end to end is a bit difficult because it reads so much like an encyclopedia. And some entries only have a paragraph or two, and some of them have nearly a page and a half and with some good photos with them, too. It's a great book. If you're into science fiction, you got to get the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction Movies by Phil Hardy. I have a picture of the newer version going by in the feed and also on the ad I posted on Facebook. So you need to check that out. Going to take another short break, and I'll be right back. We'll be right back.
The number you have reached, 911, has been changed to a non-published number.
Hello, David. Oh, no. He didn't know I was pranking him. Dave, call back. It's 646-378-0264. I was pranking him with my little recording of the number you have dialed, and that was kind of funny, I thought. Maybe Dave didn't think so, as we're talking about great horror and science fiction reference books. I hope you do call back, David. And I think he did.
What happened?
Hello?
Hello?
Did I fool you?
You did. I was trying to call 911, and I ended up with this number.
Yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean for that to go so poorly. The rest of my week hasn't been so great.
Oh, my goodness. So how has your turkey day been?
I was given the bird.
Okay, well, sometimes we do the hunting, and sometimes we are the hunted.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was very filling. Let's just say that.
You're full of it, is that what you're telling me?
Yes, I am full of it. Thanksgiving, that is. How was yours? Did you have? Did you get together with a lot of family or anything cool? Or?
We had our traditional meatloaf Thanksgiving, and
really,
we have a friend about 10 years ago. We started a tradition. He loves my wife's meatloaf, so we started preparing this meatloaf and inviting him over. He really didn't have anywhere else to go, so he always comes over for Thanksgiving and meatloaf. And with all the trimmings, of course, you know, the gravy and the corn and the rolls and the sweet potatoes and frosted brownies, you know, all the accoutrements. So, yeah. So when everyone else is sitting down to turkey dinner, we're sitting down to meatloaf.
Yeah. Now Mrs. K made the turkey with the mashed potatoes and her stuffing. She makes like a medicine ball sized thing of stuffing, and I'm the only one who eats the sweet potatoes because they're supposedly better for you than regular potatoes, and I like them both. So,
why aren't they sweet? That's why I want to know why they call them sweet potatoes.
I think they have a slightly sweet taste to them. I can see why they're made into pie as well, but you know they certainly taste different than a regular, you know, white potato.
And of course, you have your sweet potato fries to go with that.
Yeah, some of those are okay. They're not too bad. Did you have any of these kind of reference books I'm talking about?
I don't, because actually when I was growing up, I had more of an interest in television history and radio history, of course, and those,
yeah.
I do have plenty of radio and television history, but that's why I'm finding your program interesting and thought if you don't get anyone else calling in, I found it interesting when you were going through some of the different movies and giving some of the facts on the movies and the special effects and things like that, to be honest with you. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, that's why I bought them. I was just sharing this memory with somebody the other day, and you're not too far from my age, so you remember there was a time when you were younger and like a teen in the early mid-70s, maybe. I felt safe to get on a bus and then catch the rapid, go all the way downtown, because the downtown library had some books that were not available locally. And I remember twice going down there just for this one book on Ray Harryhausen. It was his life story, but it was also a big picture book, so there were lots of photos from his films, and it was worth the trip, and I had so much fun going down there and took that book out twice because I kept wanting to absorb it over and over again.
Well, but you yourself were playing with your photography, your still action movements there at the time, so that would have to be completely fascinating.
It it was a fun thing to do, and it must be very similar to what a stage magician feels like, except maybe in delay because you got to wait for the finished product to be done to get the audience reaction. But it was
right. I would imagine
using that for school projects was so much fun because people would be if they knew nothing about this stuff, how did you do that? How did you make that happen? And that was such a gift.
You've been doing this kind of magic for quite a few years, even before you got into horror hosting.
Oh yeah, when I was about 13, 14, I picked up for $2 this Standard 8. You know, before Super 8, there was a Standard 8, which is basically 16 millimeter film sliced down the middle, but an 8 millimeter film. A camera that, you know, you had to shoot on a reel yet, no less, and wind it up and take it to, you know, the drugstore to have it processed and put on a reel you could project. But one of the first things I put together was animating a chess game. I animated a fool's match because that's a very, you know, very short chess game, two moves aside. And then I made a tentacle out of silly putty. And gathered a bunch of, like, aquarium rocks and trees and stuff like that to create a foreground, and had the tentacle come out from behind a rock and grab a matchbox car and pull it away. So, yeah, I mean, doing that kind of stuff and then have people go, oh, my gosh, how did you do that? You know, that was cool.
Yeah, I would imagine. And was it Ray that kind of piqued your interest in that sort of?
Yeah, as I remember it, I think it was talking to a neighborhood friend. We had both watched, probably on Superhost at the time, Jason and the Argonauts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's like, that guy could have been, speaking about Talos, the giant statue that came to life, I said, that could have been a guy, but those skeletons, how was that done, you know? And that was right around the time I started buying Famous Monsters of Filmland and starting to explore, you know, how can I do cool stuff like that?
Yeah, those are things that are just truly amazing to watch, and then to see the final result afterwards too. Probably, how long did it take you to do something like that? I know yours weren't as
interesting. Well, when you're a kid, see, a lot of people don't understand this, but like when you're an adult, you have to go to work. Most of us, you know, and some of us don't for whatever one reason or another. But we have to go to work. When you're a kid, oh, it's awesome. I mean, a school day is not like a work day. That's only, what, 6 hours, five and a half, 6 hours, whatever.
Nope.
And you had a lot more free time and less obligations. You didn't have to worry about paying bills, whatever. And so in a weekend, I could create a couple really good animated scenes, you know, just by... We had a ping pong table that sometimes I would set up a train set on there, and of course I used a lot of Lionel train parts, like a bridge and stuff, for later projects that included full dinosaurs made out of modeling clay.
Wow.
And it was fun, and it wasn't like earth-shattering, but the cool thing was having a rear projection screen where I could... Because our school library, I went to the Bedford school system here in Ohio, Northeast Ohio, and they had a rear projection screen in the library. So I would take that out for the weekend, and I'd be like, oh, yeah. And I learned that for what was available to purchase for film, I needed like a high-speed film to shoot in low-light situations and to pick up a rear projection screen. So I found it was best to shoot in black and white because it had a faster film speed.
Ah.
So, you know, by reading these books, I learned a lot of that from the Making of King Kong book was a huge inspiration for some of this stuff. I couldn't figure out what to use for a dinosaur's teeth, and I ended up using minute rice. Uncooked rice. Or not minute rice, but uncooked rice.
Right.
For the Tyrannosaurus's teeth, and it was perfect. They were the perfect size for the dinosaur I had made. So I was like, yeah, there's his teeth. You learn to be inventive. There's so many books that I have that are in the non-horror genre. You mentioned you had a few.
Yeah.
Are there any you'd like to share?
I tell you what, one, and I don't know if it's in print anymore, radio's golden age. Just goes through, and it really only takes you up to about 1950. There are a few entries after that, like Gunsmoke, because Gunsmoke did run for over 10 years. But that and the complete history of primetime and network and cable TV shows. That they come up with a new edition of that just about every year. And mine's a little bit old, but I tell you what, it's just so much. It's so interesting to find out, in even some cases, who they wanted to star in them and things like that. So,
I should have you come back as a guest sometime and talk about old time radio. There's so much in the horror genre to really go over there. It seemed to me, there was a great deal of shows that dealt with the macabre and dark things, Inner Sanctum and the Hermit's
Lights
Cave
Out.
And Lights Out,
yep.
The Whistler.
The Witch's Tale, and some of those dating back to the mid to late 1930s. There's a lot of interesting things, even horror-related with radio, of course.
Yeah, and a lot of the old stars were on there. Peter Lorre and Vincent Price and Karloff was on so many of them, and Basil Rathbone and Claude Rains, some of the great voices of Hollywood they would have on them. And I remember go ahead.
I was surprised how often Boris Karloff, he spent a lot of time guesting on radio, a certain amount of comedy shows, but he did spend a lot of time on Inner Sanctum. He must have been a personal friend of Hyman Brown or something. But he spent a lot, and Vincent Price did several shows there, including a great one that wasn't a horror show. He did the radio version of The Saint.
Yes.
It was absolutely fantastic in that. When
he
left, he
fit that
when he left the role,
so well.
Conway came in to take his role, giving him the exact same script. It wasn't as good because I think Price had so much fun doing that role that he just he did it with a smile in his voice. It was so much fun when his episodes were on.
Yeah. And what's the name of this book again? The Golden Era of Radio.
Oh, Radio's Golden Age. It's with the programs and the personalities, but with Frank Buxton and Bill Owen. And they had a couple of versions. This was actually a hardback copy I found out at I think it was down in Dayton in a secondhand store, and I found it. And I just had to pick this up because I had a paperback version that I'd gone through so much it was literally falling apart. So I was very glad to get the hardback version.
That's cool.
Yeah, matter of fact, I paid $20 for this when I got it, and it was not new. It was a used book then, but I paid $20 for it then. So
there's a couple interesting bookstores up in Oberlin. I just bought my daughter. She's a big fan of Buster Keaton, and I bought her a great book on his life story, which she had already gathered through various resources that she has, but she really loves the book because there were a few things in there that she didn't know. And that's the beauty of books, you know, as well read as you can be on any genre, I think. I hope that books never really go away. It's getting harder and harder to find like a real book that you can hold in your hand, you know, with the advent of the internet. But there's so many good ones. I have some non-horror genre stuff that I absolutely love. I've got a great book on the Little Rascals. I have several books on the Stooges.
Yeah. I have
including
a book on Laurel
including
Hardy
the one,
and several other movie teams. Oh, I have some Laurel and Hardy, a book on Laurel and Hardy and some other movie icons as well. They had different volumes of them from the same series, yeah.
Yeah. The best book I have on the Stooges is my favorite one is the one that was written, sort of co-written by Mo Howard. His son-in-law, Norman Marrer, you know, produced and did the book. But there was just so much personal information about them growing up and how their personas, you know, grew and how they got started in vaudeville and working with Ted Healy and, you know, the troubles they had there. And you and I had talked before about you brought to my attention, in fact, that there was a time when Mantan Moreland was being considered for a third stooge.
And that Mo Howard did admit to that during one of his Mike Douglas appearances.
Yeah, they were ahead of their time in terms of being non-prejudiced, you know what I mean? And
You know what, I think a lot of the artists themselves weren't as prejudiced as, in a sense, I guess what the producers would be. Look, Frank Sinatra would hang out with Sammy Davis Jr., as would if you had talent, they didn't care what you were.
No.
And talent, Mantan Moore was really underrated as a comic, and then he was vilified for doing the things that he did to earn a living, and almost practically blacklisted for that. I mean, and yet I think he's one of the funniest movie second bananas I think you can find out there.
You know, having being billed as a second banana, and like a great example, a movie you and I have both hosted is King of the Zombies.
Yes.
And I believe that was one of the movies I didn't put any sound bites in because it's so funny with him. To me, he makes the film. He should be he should have been given the star billing because he was so funny and he stole every scene he was in.
Yeah, and Topper Returns, when Eddie Rochester Anderson was in it, he didn't get top billing, but he got the largest billing of everyone. His was down towards the bottom, but he got the largest billing. And everything he did was pure joy in that movie.
Yeah. He made the Jack Benny Show. In fact, he just gave me a horror memory that ties into the radio we were talking about, the Whistler. I remember watching an episode of Jack Benny not too long ago, maybe about a year ago. And they spoofed the Whistler, and it was called The Fiddler. So, of course, he was playing his violin. And hey, no, oh, no. Oh, you're a bad kitty. She just tore my cover of my book here of Monsters Who's Who. She found a loose end and started tearing on it. Oh, you're a bad kitty. No treats. She's about 600 pounds. She doesn't need treats. She needs Jenny Craig for kitties.
Yeah.
But, I got some great Stooges books, too. There's one's
a
book of scripts.
No matter what genre you were interested in, when you were a teenage boy, don't you think that the Stooges probably did as much for our development as anything else out there? And that was crossed all lines, I think.
They were always on. And, you know, our parents, of course, everybody heard the story about the kid who poked his eye out or whatever, and, don't do what they do. But and we had that parental guidance to have the common sense, no, you don't do that. This is pretend. This is fun. But we were inundated with Stooges. They were everywhere in the 60s and the 70s, even into the 80s. They were just always on TV, much like I Love Lucy. They were on somewhere all the time.
Yep.
And there's something very basic about their type of humor. I mean, I think it's that whole thing of slapstick.
They're pure slapstick. And yet add some decent lines to go with them as well.
Yeah, some clever turns of phrase and their own personalities in which
and
they...
And the sound effects they added to everything.
Yeah. Well, I think the sound effects made them, too. If you watch the very, very first Columbia short, you know, with Larry, Moe, and Curly, it's done in rhyme, and there's no effects. And the violence is not as effective in its comic value because it doesn't have those ridiculous sound effects, the boinks and the bonks and the... sawing of the head or whatever.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of what Big Chuck said. You know, he always used to put that laugh at the end. When they go places and show things, they didn't have the laugh. People didn't laugh along or whatever just because they weren't sure the sketch was finished or not. So they always kept putting that laugh in. That's one of the reasons I always had that laugh there. They'd know that was the end of the sketch. Plus, the laugh was so great, you had to laugh along with it, whether the sketch was that funny or not.
I know. I wonder where that came from. I have a copy of that soundbite from a Big Chuck album or something like that. Or a disc.
Yeah, the Cleveland Sound Grenade, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I picked
but,
it from. And it's still used. Some other people used it, as well as Sven Gulli even picked it up. But I thought that was something that Chuck or the guy he was working with put together, because that wasn't in the early Gulardi days. That was...
I don't know. So much of that stuff came from old comedy albums.
Yeah.
I'll have to reread Chuck's book, because I believe it mentions that, if I'm not mistaken, where some of the stuff came from. A lot of them, you know, came from the old comedy albums.
Yeah.
Another book that I picked up over the years, good fun, and again, very indicative of the era I was buying this stuff, late 70s, early 80s, Horrors, A History of Horror Movies by Tom Hutchinson and Roy Pickard. And again, lots of fantastic pictures here. They compare all the versions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, starting with the 1920 version with Barrymore, the 32 version, which is my absolute favorite, with Frederick March. But the Spencer Tracy version wasn't too bad either.
No, that wasn't too bad. And Spencer Tracy is about the last person you really expect to star in that movie.
Yeah. What's amazing is, I believe, is it Barrymore that did it completely without makeup, the transformation?
Wow.
In the 1920 version. I'm going to have to host that someday. I'd like to see more silent movies hosted. The problem with them is they're hard to watch for today's audience, a silent movie, and follow along. It's just less engaging. We're so spoiled with not only the effects, but great music and just the ambient sounds of what's going on in the action. But,
That's why it's nice to every once in a while, some Charlie Chaplin shorts and things like that, where they've added not only music, but the sound effects and stuff. We showed The Fireman with one of our shows that we did from the Fire Museum in Mansfield. And it's tremendous, because they added the sound and a couple screams and the sound effects and things like that. That, like you said, we're spoiled, and we've come to expect that.
Yeah. Now, this particular book, A History of Horror Movies, Horrors, also gets into more, I think, than any of the other books that I've mentioned, in addition to the great, you know, films out of Hollywood and so forth, and the B-movies, what have you. But they get into the television horrors, too. There were some great television horrors. There's books on that, too, some I just don't have much familiarity with because I don't own them or haven't read them. But some of the great TV stuff like Kolchak.
One of my favorite all-time shows.
And the original movie that started it all, The Night Stalker, was absolutely terrifying at the time.
And up until Roots was the highest, the most watched television movie ever. And as a single event, it still may be. As a particular movie, Roots had a higher rating, but that was a miniseries.
Yeah.
But the Kolchak, The Night Stalker, and then The Night Strangler with Richard Dean Anderson, I thought was very, very well done, which is what led to the offer of the series. Seems like a lot. There was a time in the mid-70s where they had to have like two pilot films before they would go ahead and even think of producing a series, to see what the reaction would be to those.
Yeah, well, Kolchak made the grade. The Night Stalker was extremely good. The Night Strangler was pretty good. Now, was that the one with the Jack the Ripper story, right?
No, Jack the Ripper was the first one. The second one was with the in Seattle about the it was killing people, taking parts of parts of their blood or something for a serum for everlasting life, a youth serum.
Oh, okay.
And it was
because The Night Stalker was the vampire story.
Right, that was the vampire story in Las Vegas, right.
Right.
A Vegas vampire.
No, they would revisit the vampire one more time in the hour long drama series of the Night Stalker.
Yeah, that I remember.
I'll tell you how great that was. That was what inspired the X-Files.
Yeah, another very good anthology series. another made for TV movie that I found really interesting. You could kind of call it horror because it had kind of a mysterious ending. Was the movie Duel? Did you ever see Duel with Dennis Hopper?
Duel with Dennis Weaver.
Dennis Weaver. I'm sorry. Did I say Dennis Hopper? I meant Dennis Weaver.
Dennis Weaver. Yeah, and that was Steven Spielberg's first feature, his first full movie he directed.
Yes, absolutely. And it what a great start. It was, to me, an underrated film. It really didn't get a lot of play. It didn't get a lot of excitement. But anybody who saw it really enjoyed it. It was bothersome that you never saw who was driving the truck.
Yeah. I don't think he ever saw it either.
Mm-mm. Not even after the movie's climax, which we'll try do our best not to be spoilers here.
Even
after the climax, you don't get to see who or if or what. You knew somebody was in the truck that had boots, but you never really saw who was driving that truck in a whole movie.
Yep.
It really was a duel between that little car and the truck.
So as a side piece of trivia, do you know what the first thing that Steven Spielberg directed for television?
I do not.
It was part of the original pilot movie for the Night Gallery had three different stories in it, and he directed the part with Joan Crawford.
Yes, yeah, and that was a good movie / pilot for Night Gallery. I think one of the stories had Roddy McDowell with the.
Yes. Oh, that was probably the best one of the three. About the picture, on the wall that kept changing.
Yes. And he was haunted by some dead relative or something, but.
His uncle. Yes.
Yeah. That,
yes.
Mm-hmm. That was very good. Another made-for-TV movie. I don't know how we got on that from books, but it's a good, interesting topic. Let's roll with it. But another one that scared the living hell out of me was with Kim Darby. And I used to call the little monsters the coconut heads. And what was it called? Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And I think it was the whispering of those little creatures, you know, whispering like in the long shots when they introduce or come out of a scene and you knew those little creatures were plotting and scheming and just hearing them whisper. That was really creepy.
Yeah.
Wow. Here's another film I've heard a lot of people talk about. Maybe you've seen this one, David. Another made-for-TV one. It was about something about gargoyles living in a cave or something like that.
No,
somehow I missed it, and everybody at school was talking about it in the 70s. And
well, you know, it was interesting because your networks used to have two or three movies that ran a week, and half the time they were all on different nights. So it was that's all gone. Networks don't create movies anymore. Your cable channels do.
Yeah, and by gosh, they're doing great. Look at how AMC is doing with The Walking Dead. Jeez.
Yeah.
There's a franchise for you. I'm still intrigued by the series. I look forward to each and every show every week.
Oh, it's one of my son's favorite shows.
Yeah.
His favorite show.
Yep. So definitely, the other thing I really wanted to bring up too. About all of this with the books and the reference books and things like that is, again, life is different for parents, I'm sure, now with, you know, it's seemingly computers and pads and things everywhere. But I would highly encourage you need to teach your kids to read books while we still have them. You know what I mean? They're just a wonderful resource. There's a lot of the material, I think, that's not going to make its way to the internet.
Right. There is so much quick information on the internet that you can fill your time up with, but the fact is it's not in-depth information. Because if it were in depth, I think it would lose a lot of people that go to the internet, and that's fine. But like I think you've got it right where you said we need to teach them to be able to read books.
Yeah. My parents didn't.
No depth on the internet. There's none.
I don't think my parents appreciated it as much as maybe parents today might. Things are certainly different. But my love for comic books and horror is what encouraged me to become an avid reader. These were the only things that I was reading that was nonfiction. I used to really absorb a lot of fiction, you know, different novels like the, while we're into books here, the Conan the Barbarian books that were written directly from the Robert E. Howard stories from the pulps. These are not the pastiches that were written by other authors. Rather, it was Conan how he was meant to be. And they were really, really good. I still have those paperbacks and things like that that I've saved too. I'll have to save that paperbacks for another show sometime, I think, because that's a whole another ball of wax. You know, I read a lot of sword and sorcery. I read a lot of even novel adaptations of movies that were out. You know what I mean? They're almost word for word like the movie, but yet a little different.
Yeah. I always kind of got into biographies and autobiographies. Again, that's how you get the behind-the-scenes story of people and what they did.
I remember reading Yes, I Can, Sammy Davis Jr., and learning how he lost his eye and, you know, some of the tough things he grew up with and overcame and became a huge superstar.
Yeah.
You hit the nail on the head when you said it's more in depth. It's something I hadn't thought about, but absolutely to spend the time to, especially back in the days before the computers, when journalism was journalism, and you had to do the legwork to find out information and double verify your sources and everything else instead of two or three clicks like people do now. You know what I mean? It first of all, it expresses their love of a particular genre to put the time in to put a book together for people like you and me to read and enjoy and learn.
Yeah, there is a lot missing if all of your information comes from the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always television. No, I'm kidding. Because everything on the news is true.
Yeah.
Not
quite.
Conversation there.
Yeah, that is, yeah. And it's not that, I think there's more information than misinformation on the internet, but like you said, it's not in depth. It's hit and miss. It's thrown a few facts out there that are interesting, but what sometimes, as you know, doing what we do, the story behind the story is usually more interesting than the story itself half the time.
Yeah, you're so right, and that brings again to mind the book that Shadowsky wrote. That's another good, should have been a coffee table size book. It's more like an oversized paperback, the version I have anyway. And oh my gosh, there's so many personal stories of him with Ernie Anderson and some of the crazy things that Ernie did that never made it to the show. Riding his motorcycle through the TV studio just because.
and he was the only one who could get away with it. So what they do, they sent out a memo. The next day said, there will be no riding of motorcycles through the halls by anyone. You know, so it's not like they even confronted him directly.
Yeah,
they were so afraid of him because he was that powerful. Yeah,
and that's exactly what I think. Part of the problem with television, we've said this a million times. You and I have discussed it before too. Is, you know, the corporate control thing is just absolutely stifling creativity and the ability to do local shows like Horror Hosts and like the old kiddie shows, because I don't think they want
But how much does it cost to buy all these syndicated programs? That's got to cost you some. You're not paying people, and you're not paying, but they're because all the actors and writers are getting royalties. So this is not free that they're getting. So the question is, why don't they encourage more people to try to produce local programming? You and I have talked about that quite a bit.
I don't know. Maybe we become too judgy as a people. You know what I mean? There's some people that were totally turned off by Horror Hosts, but Horror Hosts are not supposed to be perfect. You know, they have their imperfections, and some of them would gloat, like the ghoul would always talk about the mediocrity of his show and blah, 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 and this is the way it's supposed to be, damn it.
almost all of your local programs of that nature, whether it be the kids show or that, because you never knew what was going to happen, and there wasn't great budget, so you might have had some stuff written, and you go ahead and perform what you've got and work with what you got. But things happen all the time, and it happens live, and you have no idea, absolutely no idea, as to what was going to happen. And if you can't plan for that, then you just roll with it. And if you're going to roll with it and things happen and they go, it's just... It doesn't look as professional or polished as something that's filmed that they can film 15 takes of and take the right one and get the next 15 takes of something else.
I think, and that's the thing, the powers that be have decided that's what people want to see, is a perfectly polished everything.
And why did we ever have this, although it's dying, why do we ever have this reality TV binge that everything went on? I'll tell you why. A writer's strike. Started it all, and they found it was cheaper and easier to put together. But that's certainly not professional.
You've got a very, very good point there. With a little less than 90 seconds to go, with the hour being up here, there is no Eerie House TV, folks. Sorry. We'll try to come back some way, somehow. Going to have to find a new venue, apparently. Something happened, and have to move forward.
I didn't know that. I also didn't know this was an hour program anymore.
I recently expanded to an hour. Some changes were forced upon me here at Blog Talk, and I opted a particular direction right now. So in addition to the extended time, we've got unlimited sound bites.
What's not on Eerie House Television tonight, Dale?
You name it, and it's not on. How about that?
Okay, I'll make a list.
Okay. We'll have some interesting outgo music here with a little less than 10 seconds to go. Thanks for calling in, Dave, and let's experiment together and see if there's an after party.
let's do that.
I've never tried it before. And apparently we're still being recorded. How about that?
There you go. Yeah, because we're still didn't cut me off yet.
I was glad you spoke. I was kind of hesitant. Uh-oh, maybe it is over.
You know, I realized, and I just don't have the books in the background to talk on like you did. So I did pull out my Radio's Golden Age, my TV directory, just to have it here. And then I kept looking at the clock, and I said, wow, what's happening here? But at the top it does say 1 hour, but I just didn't know about that.
Yeah. I'll be darned. Time flies.
Yes.
Yeah, I just
and it
can't
was
believe
fun.
This
Thank
cat.
You.
I can't believe this cat took a loose end of a book cover and tried to run with it. Five on my show. Shame on you.
just trying to see what they could get from you there.
It's like having kids. You can't get too mad at them when they're dumb. When they're young and dumb.
Hey, it wasn't that long ago we were young and dumb. Now we're just old and not so smart.
Yeah, well, it's still amusing. Having cats with no brains is... I've had a cat that was, like, absolutely a brilliant and had a perfect cat and just perfect personality. But these flawed fools that are running around my house now are fun as hell to watch.
Yeah, one I got three of them.
One can't drink and he snorts the water up his nose. It's hilarious.
I got one that loves to camp out here on my desk where I do the writing and editing.
Yeah? Oh, that's cool. Yeah, this one hangs out when I'm up to my creative endeavors, which are somewhat stifled at the moment, but maybe that'll give me time to do one of my own shows. I haven't done one in quite a while now.
Yeah.
I'm
overdue. You're always busy helping everyone else to share their things, and that's an important thing. I think I texted you once that, you know, what you do is so important because, you know, all I do is I make content, but you provide content and share others' work with everyone else, and that is such an important thing.
Apparently,
otherwise,
the powers that be feel that should not be for whatever reason, but here we are.
Wow. You got locked out of the original.
Yeah.
Twice. Oh, I'm sorry to hear.
Twice in a week, so. And so I don't know. It is what it is. I got books, boy. I got books galore. Maybe I'll have time to read them. No, I've been exploring other venues and seeing what's available and what can and cannot be done. If I can't do it right, I'm not going to do anything with that. Just
a whole other
fun thing to do. But for the interim, I don't want to give up on this because it is fun working with the other horror hosts such as yourself, and putting the shows out there. And at least I get to talk like this about cool stuff like books.
Absolutely. And you still do have the venue here.
Yeah,
and,
that's what I mean. This is a lot of fun. And you've heard some of my guests recently. That Gar the Ghoul, he's insane.
He is insane. But the thing is, once you get him there, you don't have to talk a whole lot. So.
Yeah, no, I don't. He's just like a party all by himself.
But that's
entertaining.
It is.
I haven't caught his internet show yet, but maybe I'll have time now.
You know what?
I do
that myself because I'm really curious because he does that live, right?
And that's got to be challenging. I mean, it's one thing, and you, amongst all the people I know the best because you do your own editing and your own, you know, production work. It's time consuming. You put things together, but imagine the pressure of doing it live.
You know, it's funny with what I do. It's interesting how the different volunteers have worked, where some of them love the live, because if they say something and it's done, it's out there, it's gone forever, you can never stop it. So for them, the scary thing was in pre-recording it, where there were others that they could not go live because they were afraid of what they might say. The same thing. And so it's really interesting. For me, I always like the security of being able to say, take two, you know.
Yeah.
So I think what he does takes a tremendous amount of noise.
Yeah, it does. And I tell you what, I like both. And having experienced both, I mean, doing stuff on various radio things, both real radio and otherwise. I don't know if you'd call this real radio or not. You know, having done, you know, broadcast radio, a few shows here and there, both as a guest and as a host. And working on pre-produced stuff and a mixture of being live is fun for me. Having done the DJ work for years where, you know, you're right there in front of people live, and if you screw up, you better know how to cover up, you know. And not that that happens often, but, you know, when you do it long enough, you're bound to make mistakes, and also you're going to learn from them and how to make them better and actually turn them into opportunities by ad-libbing well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Is this the first week of the one-hour show, or...?
No. It's been this is maybe the second or third one now.
Okay.
It's cool. You know what I mean? If everything that needs to be said is said, we'll end early. But that hasn't happened yet. I've had the beauty of good people to call in and bounce stuff off with.
Okay.
So I like it. I like it. I think it's going to give me more opportunity to do things with some pre-recorded stuff that you and I discussed before. And
right, now, they're giving you more spots for
well, you know, you
then?
Do, if I didn't have to, as I mentioned, work for a living, I would do this every day, because you're allowed to do one, even in, under the old way with the half-hour shows, you can do one a day. You can do one a day. You got a half an hour a day now. I got an hour. I believe it's actually 2 hours.
I meant adding the audio clips is what I meant.
Oh.
Are you still limited to the – well, you know what? With a half hour –
No, I'm no longer limited. I'm no longer limited to just three.
Okay.
Because I could have stuff like
– I'm sorry, but it's too late. Santa's going to have to kill you.
Or
– this just in, Santa Claus is dead.
And that's for our cheery holiday season. And there's always...
Make me a Sergeant Jackson food!
Which you know is my favorite.
Well, you know what? That would give you an opportunity to share some of those radio dramas you like so much, having a full hour.
Absolutely, because I can host the hosted show.
Right. In a sense, yes.
And share with others who might be interested in doing the same thing. And, hey, you want to come on Erie House Radio and host whatever. You know, whatever we can find. I'm not as believe me, I'm by no means an expert on public domain, nor do I profess to be, nor do I play one on television. But I think a lot of the movies and TV shows are pretty widely known and accepted as what's public domain and what isn't, for the most part.
Right.
There's some borderline movies that some choose to cross the lines and some choose not to. But I'm not as well versed on radio, and I feel I need to do a lot of research before I start throwing stuff out here.
I think that most of your, except some of your newer stuff, you were being from these, everything beyond that, most of those things were never even copywritten. The old radio programs. They never thought there, well, it's like they never thought there would be a market
just
for
like
a
television. Yeah, just like TV.
Yeah.
A lot of
absolutely.
It was not copyrighted because they didn't figure it's going to be ever seen again.
Yeah, and so it the old radio is the old ones, you know, the Hyman Browns, the family does something to protect that somewhat. I know there's a website, a radio streaming station that airs some, but I'm not so sure that they're working. I think they must be working with the family, the way they're edited down and such. But his are protected, and probably the Jim French pieces are still protected, things like that. But outside of that, most, because that would be your crisis in the 60s, and he's still doing stuff now out in Seattle. But most all of the old radio programs are all in public domain.
That's cool, because that's something I'd like, because I discovered those shows very late in life. I've heard, you know, of a few things like The Shadow and this and that growing up, but I never, you know, I was not the radio generation. I was the television generation.
Right. And, you and I just have about a half a year between us, I think. And it was in junior high that I really found out about and fell in love with radio drama and comedy. And
that was much later for me. Much later for me.
Yeah, that's when I started really looking and finding and reading and listening. And back then, it was a lot harder to get through the internet. It's all out there.
Thank goodness. The only thing I found easy to find then was a reel-to-reel in our library of the Orson Welles War of the Worlds. That was easily found. But it wasn't until much later with satellite radio in one of my cars where I really woke up and got to hear all these old, incredible shows, and not just the horror shows, but how many of them, which much later became the television programs I was familiar with.
Absolutely, yeah. So.
Bill Conrad is Matt Dillon? What?
I tell you what, there are parts of me that Bill Conrad reached as Matt Dillon that James Arness never did. His voice, he had such a great voice, but he was a better actor. James Arness didn't have a lot of range.
Yeah.
But he was a great Matt Dillon. Don't get me wrong. He was a great Matt Dillon.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have a lot of range. Conrad had a lot more range than that. A thousand radio programs from not just the Gunsmoke, but he was a regular for CBS, where he did Escapes, and he did I just listened to one earlier when I was out raking the leaves. Randy Stone, the reporter, he was in a lot of those. And every time he turned around, you could hear his voice and knew who it was. Even if it was a little different type of role, but usually it was the tough guy with a heart, a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
Literally thousands of old radio programs he was part of when it was on live.
I always felt if I ran for
10 years, and they did a lot more weeks of radio than we do with television.
Yeah. I always promised myself if I ever went blind that I would somehow get somebody to get me every possible radio show imaginable, because you experience so much from a radio show that you don't get from a television show, because you get to use your own mind as the movie camera.
And everybody sees it differently.
Uh-huh. You customize it to how you're – just like reading a book. Back to square one. That was a nice way to come full circle here as we come to the end of our extra time.
Wow, that was fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it was. Oh, well, you made it that way.
I'm sure you planned to take it, but I hope I was able to help out a little bit.
You helped out a lot. I was just starting to get to the point where it's like, yeah, I might make this a half-hour show, and then you called in. Well, because, quite honestly, I mean, I ran out of the I didn't want to stray too far from the non-horror genre by myself. So,
right.
Anyway, they're going to cut us off in a few seconds here, David. Thank
All
you
right.
for calling Erie House Radio.
Very good. All right.
And I'll talk to you soon offline.
Okay, very good.
All right. Bye.
Bye.